I feel short. My name is Angela. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Angela.
My sobriety date is September 29, 2006, and I want to thank Billy for asking me to come out here. I've been here before, and in fact, for a workshop and a couple times for speaking, and it's just a beautiful place, and there's beautiful people here, and people that I remember listening to and still listen to in the car on CDs and learning from, and I've had so much encouragement and love from this group and from people in this group, and I just really appreciate being able to come and share. So I like the reading that you guys do about that my job here is to talk about how I've had how I've developed my relationship with God through the program of AA. Because while I do like to, you know, tell what it was like and what happened and what it's like now, all of that, my development of my relationship with God is, thank you, is all through that. And it ebbs and flows. It waxes and wanes. You know, that kind of relationship, some days is good and some days is bad. I've gotten up to talk and just been like, you know, had no spirit in me that day, and that's really hard. Right now, I'm in a kind of a fragile place in my life. My father right now is in the, if I cry a little bit, I'm sorry. He's in the ICU. He has been since last Saturday, and he was 2 weeks ago was in the ICU for 5 days, and things are getting better, but, you know, it's one of those where life throws out things, you know, and I want to be a good daughter, and thank goodness I'm sober so I can be a good daughter. I get up early, go to the hospital in the morning, I go to work, and then go to the hospital after work, and then I go home, cook, or do laundry, and, you know, do it over again. And I'm exhausted. But I'm also grateful. You know, I'm so grateful. And I think that keeping that at the foremost of my mind, just all the things I thank every nurse that walks in, every attendant, every person who walks in and takes the trash out or the linens out, I'm like, thank you. Thank you so much for doing that. I just appreciate their service. And, you know, AA has taught me to live a life like that. AA has taught me to thank my preacher. I mean, when I came to AA, I was a very active member of my church. I thought, you know, my only problem was I drank too much. I mean, I'm a good person, you know, but I didn't even know little things like don't get up and go to the bathroom during the service. That's rude. I didn't know that. I'm like, well, I've got to go. You know, I didn't know little things like go up and thank him for just now sharing his sermon after he's prepared all week. I didn't know to go thank the preacher. You know, I learned that here, going to speaker meetings and going to conferences and my sponsor saying, okay, everyone's in line. I'm like, why are they in line? Well, they're in line to thank the speaker. Okay, you know, and I learned that. And I just did it. I didn't realize how important it was until I actually became the person up here disclosing my ugly story, right? And yeah, it's what does it say? I'm sorry if it's in poor taste, but it is necessary to disclose the ugliness to show that this is a miracle that's happened here. You know, when I was little, I watched my dad drink. He was a Marine. We were out in California. My mom, when she was pregnant, they had already split up once and gotten back together when they found out he was going to be stationed in California. And when we were out there, you know, I'm sure he drank before, but then it really took off. And then we got back to Virginia, and I saw the arguing and the fighting and the drinking, and I knew it had something to do with it. And I swore I wasn't going to do that. I swore I wasn't going to drink. I didn't want to be like my dad. I really blamed that for their divorce. You know, it had to be the alcohol because they're both such good people, so it must be this other thing. And so for a long time, I was able not to drink, you know. But I went through puberty, and, you know, in puberty, the hormones make you crazy. Well, they make me crazy. So the hormones really kicked in, and I thought I was going insane. And I didn't realize... I didn't know I was alcoholic. I didn't even know what alcoholism was. You know, if you said, what was an alcoholic, I'd say it's that bum with the bag under the bridge. That's an alcoholic. That's what I would have said. It's someone on Skid Row. So I thought I was crazy. I was in high school. So if something happened, like if a boyfriend broke up with me, it was the end of the world. If a girlfriend said something bad about me, it was the end of the world. Everything was... very dramatic, and I was either really up or I was really down. And so I thought, you know, there's something wrong with me, you know, and I would try so hard. I would make straight A's. I would go try out for cheerleading. I would be on the cheerleading squad. I'd date the quarterback of the football team. You know, I would do everything that looked like it would fix me. And none of it did. I always felt like I didn't have the book. Like everyone got the manual and I didn't. Because everyone seemed like they knew what to say when you called someone on the phone. But I didn't even know how to call someone on the phone and say, how are you? Because I thought you could only call someone on the phone if you had something to tell them or if you had to make a plan. Like, I wouldn't call you and just say, how's your day going? I didn't know what that was. I didn't understand that. And so then when people at school had these relationships, I would see them with these relationships because they had talked the night before on the phone, and they knew what each other had for dinner the night before. And so I'd get to school, and I'd think, they know so much about each other. You know, they're really close. Not realizing that they had these tools of friendship that I just didn't have. And I don't, and you know, a lot of that is ego and fear and, you know, but I think it's a family dynamic that just was perpetuated on and on. Now, I also had the disease of alcoholism. So finally, I took a drink. Well, why didn't you tell me it was going to be so good? I mean, I would have done it much earlier. You know, I'd really abstained for so long because seeing my dad and my mom and fighting and all that, you know, I didn't want to drink. So finally, just because I liked this boy and I wanted him to like me, I took a drink. And, you know, like they say, I took a drink and the drink took me, you know. And this boy knew how to get it, so he was the one because he could get alcohol. And so starting on Mondays, I'd start, you know, thinking, okay, who are we going to go get to buy us drinks on beer on Friday? Or who's going to go to the who has a big brother or big sister that can go to the liquor store for us? And I would start planning that stuff on Monday for Friday. In high school, we had, okay, so I was a cheerleader. And somebody was having, like, a tequila party. Now, I didn't drink every day, you know, but when I did, it was pretty heavy. It was out of control, really. And I would do things to even increase the effect. So I had to cheer a game. There was a tequila party, and my friend and I decided we're going to give blood that morning because it's going to help with the effect, you know, and it did. You know, at the end of that night, it was snowing, and I ended up in the backyard in the snow, kind of like passed out over a canoe, and luckily I had a good friend who got me and dragged me home and dumped me on my foyer of my house, you know. And, you know, I remember that now. I got to thank him one day. So, but that's how I drank. Weird things like that would happen to me. You know, I got a little bit older, went to Williamsburg, went to the REM concert, and passed out in the bathroom at the concert. You know, blacked out, passed out. I don't know. My friends didn't know where I was. They didn't know where. Yeah, that's right. Anyway, so they walked. They finally got a security guard, and they found me in the bathroom, stall, passed out. You know, but I didn't know. I mean, I just thought I was like a partier. You know, I'm just a lush. I would say I'm just a lush. You know, that's all. I'm just a lush. But that's how I drank. And, you know, I'm lucky that nothing really, really terrible happened to me because I put myself in the position to be harmed many times. And I've also had good friends look out for me and make sure I got home, which is really just a miracle. As I got older and was ending college, I knew that I was watching my friends as they were graduating, and they were going out and getting jobs, and they weren't hanging out with me as much anymore. And I went to a girlfriend's house. She was in college at Clemson, and she had just graduated, and she said, come stay with me for the weekend. And I went to her house for the weekend, and she had all these suits hung up in her room. And she says, look at all these new suits that my mom just took me to get suits for interviews. And I'm like, interviews for what? You know? She's like, interviews for a job. I'm like, you're going to wear, like, a job with suits, you know? Like, you're going to wear a suit and get, like, a job that you have to wear a suit? And she's like, well, yeah, you know, I just graduated. That's what I'm going to do. And, you know, that was just so foreign to me. And I was graduating the next year. And I couldn't imagine having a job, a real job that I had to commit to every day. You know, I was a bartender. You know, that's what I did while I was in college. Well, I aspired to be the bartender. And finally, I got my dream job of bartending, you know. I mean, it really was. I mean, I started as the hostess, and like, well, can you let me serve drinks now? And then I'd serve drinks, I'd start making some more money. And then by the time I got to be a bartender, I was making a lot of money. And somehow along the way, classes became not so important. And it took me a couple extra years to get through college. In fact, a big hoax was I actually went through graduation but never got the certificate because at some point I missed a letter of some sort of letter I was supposed to get for a transfer credit, and I never got it, and I just let it go, and I just kept saying, well, I'll do that next week, I'll do that next week, I'll do that when school starts again in the fall, when the teacher's back, I'll get the letter. Oh, I'll do that next, I mean, that's how I do, and I've thought I've done it so many times that I've thought about doing it so many times, I think I've done it, and I haven't done it, but it's been on my mind so long that it's like I've done it. So when I was about, I guess I was like 23, you know, I realized that that I drank differently than other people. And it was very uncomfortable when my friends started leaving and going and getting jobs and they stopped hanging out with me. And I just started hanging out with new friends. And I actually really started hanging out with my husband, who I have now. And we drank together all the time. I mean, that's how we bonded. We drank together. You know, everything we did had to do with drinking. You know, we joined a dart league, and I was great at drunk darts. I mean, I was really, surprisingly enough, I was really great at drunk darts. But the problem with that is that, you know, then we'd do stuff, we'd go home, we'd be practicing darts, and I'd say stupid stuff like, let's see what happens when you put your hand there, and, you know, and we'd do that. And, you know, just really dumb stuff. And I moved back to Virginia because I thought I would go to dental school in Virginia. I mean, believe it or not, my grades are still decent. I mean, I don't know how that happens, but I maintained grades. I just did. And moved back to Virginia with the hopes of going to dental school. But my alcoholism kept getting worse when, you know, I just kept drinking more and more. And it took more for me to get to the place I needed to be okay. You know, I started working for a dentist thinking that, you know, okay, I'm going to work for this dentist and see if it works out and see, you know, see if I really like this field. And I would go in there and I would be so smelly that even the person at the reception desk would say, were you out last night? You know, and I realized, oh my gosh, I still smell from yesterday, from last night's drinking. So I learned some clever ways of covering that up. Peanut butter was very effective. Peanut butter seems to cover up a lot of smells. It has a very strong aroma. And so I started covering up my drinking. I started doing things like, you know, water, drink, trying to control my drinking. I, you know, stopped drinking hard liquor and would only drink like wine and beer. I went through all that rigmarole we do, you know, trying to figure out what is the magic combination, what's going to be okay, how can I still drink and then still show up for work at, you know, for the 7:30 meeting. And it was just crazy. So, you know, obviously I need to grow up. I need to grow up. I need to get married and have a baby. That's going to fix me, right? And so, you know, now I did get the pregnancy part before the marriage part. So that is, I had a little persuasion in the marriage arena. You know, I don't know if I would have gotten married at that time had I not gotten pregnant. But at the same time, I got pregnant because, you know, I was living a very careless lifestyle and not being responsible, you know. So we got married. Now, we got married, and I really thought, this is it. I'm going to grow up. I'm going to be better. I've got this plan. I've always wanted to be a mother. My whole life I've wanted to be a mother. So, and I'm going to be a good mother. I had this plan on how I was going to, you know, be the best mom. And I did stop drinking. So what happens when I stop drinking? I got so crazy. I was the biggest control freak you've ever seen. I had these charts that went with the diaper bag. And everything was itemized, what was in the diaper bag. And when I would give you my child, and I'd give you the diaper bag, and you brought them back to me, I would go down the chart, and I would make sure everything was still in the diaper bag, you know. And, I mean, and then I'd say, well, where is that? Where is that Ipecac syrup, you know? It's missing, you know, because I had this very just strict way of doing it. It just had to be a certain way. I had this color-coded calendar. You know, if it's in this color, it's optional. If it's in this color, it's something for my husband. If it's this color, it's church. If it's this color, it's, you know, fun. If it's this color, it's doctor. You know, and I had this big color code. And that, because for my life to make sense without alcohol, I had to, like, just get it so. It had to be just so for me to be safe. You know, and I couldn't pull that off very long. I mean, as soon as, you know, my baby was a little bit older and I wasn't breastfeeding, I was drinking. And I was glad that we stopped the breastfeeding. In fact, I couldn't relax enough to let that happen. I mean, I couldn't do it because I was just so tense. And so I did start drinking again. Well, then I got pregnant again. Then I stopped drinking. And then, I mean, so I stopped pretty much for a good part of, like, late 20s, early 30s. I'm not alcoholic then because I could stop, you know, obviously. So after my second daughter started, like, going to the bathroom and stuff by herself, I started drinking again. Every Friday, then every Friday, Saturday, then every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, then every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and sometimes Sunday after church. But only if I was with like the little family gathering, you know. And it was so funny because I thought, oh, I can't believe I'm drinking on Sunday, you know, because at that point I'd gotten really involved in my church. I was going to Bible study. I was going to church. I was teaching a 2-year-old little music class. I was I was going to church 4 times a week. You know, I had this God thing. But so why wasn't he helping me with the alcohol thing? I mean, I would wake up in the morning and I'd be so hungover and I'd have to get these little kids ready and I'd have to make them look perfect because if they don't look perfect, then I'm not a good mom. And then I'd pack their lunches and I'd get them off and then I'd lay back down and maybe go dry heave some in the toilet. Or I'd have to volunteer at the school, and I'd go up to the school, and I would be in the kindergarten room, and the little toilet's about 12 inches high in the kindergarten room, and I would be, like, laying on the floor like this, trying to, you know, be sick in the toilet of the kindergarten room because I'm so hungover from the night before. And what I don't realize, it's not even a hangover. It's I'm detoxing. You know, I'm in withdrawal. And I didn't know what hair of the dog was. I didn't know that's all I really needed was a drink. But because, you see, if I drank, I was alcoholic because I'd be drinking in the morning, so I couldn't do that. And I was so miserable. Oh, my gosh. And, you know, by the time my daughter was 5 and she finished kindergarten, she was, I mean, that wasn't very long. It was like a couple years, and my alcoholism just took off like crazy. And they say that happens in women, that the progression can go really fast sometimes in women. And, you know, I had taken that little break having the babies, and so when I picked it back up, it was on. And, you know, I really didn't understand it at all. I was bewildered. So what else was going on at that time of my life? Oh, a couple of different interesting things happened through the kids and through their teachers. The kindergarten teacher at one point grabbed my hand and just said, when I was leaving one day, and she knew I was sick, but I was still doing my duty because I'm a good mom, and she kind of looked at me in the eyes and she said, take care of yourself, you know, in a really special way that she said that. And I knew she knew something was going on with me. And then that was with my daughter. And my son was in, at that time, he was in, I guess he was in second grade. He was drawing all in black, and he wouldn't use anything but black crayons. And I kept having to go buy new boxes of crayons just to provide more black crayons, and which I was going to do. I did because he loved to draw. And the teachers had this little parent-teacher conference, and all the teachers were there, and the principal and us, and you know that we're talking about him and how he's not doing exactly what he's supposed to be doing, but I mean he still was making all good grades and reading a lot, but he still had these weird things going on, and it dawned on me. I kept saying, well, first I was thinking, I've got to fix him, you know, and then I thought, I need to do something about me. Maybe if I just do something about me, maybe these other things will kind of clear up. Maybe it's not him. Maybe it's me. And it just, for just a split second, I had enough clarity to, you know, the finger pointing out and the three, and I realized there were three pointing back. And that if I would just address what I knew I had something going on, that maybe my family life, maybe some people in my family would heal as well. And so I just had a little bit of clarity with that. And all this, just by grace, all kind of happened, and someone invited me, a family member invited me to come with them to pick up their 90-day chip, which I didn't know what that was. I said, okay, I'll come with you. And I went with them, and I sat at the table, and everyone started talking about this part of the big book, which, you know, we were in the blue big book, and they read like a passage from it, and they were talking about their alcoholism and what it felt like, and they were talking about the shame. They were talking about waking up in the morning and going, oh my gosh, I did it again. They were talking about making a decision to quit, that I've got it, I'm going to stop tomorrow. And I was like, oh my gosh. And then I thought, she told them about me. I honestly, you know, it's always about me, right? And for just a moment, I thought that. And then I realized, no, there's no way, because she doesn't know this stuff about me. I mean, she knows some of it, but she didn't know the depths of it because I was so secretive. The only person who really knew how I drank was my husband. He's the only, and he covered for me beautifully. You know, he always covered for me. So I went back to that same meeting with her again, and she was out of town the next week, and I was going to this meeting hungover, okay, very stinky and hungover. And she was out of town like the third week, and that third week it was in September, and she wasn't there, but something, and I wasn't planning on joining this thing. I mean, I just wanted to listen to what they were saying because they were giving me some good tips, you know, good ways to handle some situations in life. I just needed some, what do they call them now, life hacks. I just needed some life hacks just to get me through some of these little rough patches. I certainly did not need to join this group because I wasn't an alcoholic. And something at the end, they read the 9-step promises. And then they said, did anyone want to pick up a white chip? Does anyone want to try this way of life? And I was just out of my seat. And I was like, who made me stand up? Like, because I did not want to stand up and join this group. I did not want to pick up that white chip, but I did. I just got up and I was just overcome with emotion. Because it was like a turning point. It was like a glimpse of hope. It was like, I'm just getting ready to just do something that I didn't want to do, but it's okay. Because I've been doing something I didn't want to do for a long time. I mean, I've been drinking against my will for a long time. So, but this was different because these people were happy and smiling and honest, and they had something. And those 9-step promises, oh my gosh, I thought that was baloney. Those things couldn't possibly come true. But you know what? I'll give it a shot, you know. Because you said it does, and you know, maybe even if one or two of them worked out, it'd be great. I don't need the whole list. Heck, one, you know, one would be good. So yeah, I picked up that white chip, and it was a big moment. But and you know, and everyone came around me, and everyone's like, "Take my number," and everyone's giving me their numbers, and you know how we do that, and it was great. I wasn't offended by that. I didn't mind that because I was so not even conscious of it, really. I was just surrounded by love is all I felt. But I didn't go to another meeting because that was a spiritual experience, right? I mean, it was. It was one. And it was a big one for me because I had really kind of stopped having spiritual experiences. I mean, I remember as a kid having certain moments of what I would describe as moments of like transcendence, moments of just incredible beauty and awe. And I thought, oh, like I know there's a God in this moment. But then it would pass. Or I'd have a moment of someone doing something really kind for me and something really generous for me. And at that moment, I felt so held and so loved. And that was a spiritual experience. But then the next day, that was gone too. You know? And so I kind of equated it just like that. I thought, well, you know, and then it was gone. And by 6 days later, I had a drink again. So I went back. Maybe I didn't listen well enough to how to do this, apparently. You got to do a little more than pick up the white chip. And they said, well, let me just tell you what I did, because this is kind of interesting, and I think it's important because it did affect me. And I went to a morning meeting that Friday, so it was a week later. So my last drink was on the 28th. My sobriety date's the 29th. I'm pretty sure that I'll have to match up on the calendar. But that morning, I went to a women's meeting that Friday morning, and I knew, I'm like, I got to go back to AA. And I'd never been to this group, and I went to it because it was the first one I could get up and get ready and get to, and it was at 10:30 or so in the morning. And they talked about the whole, and this was an AA meeting, and all they talked about was prescription drugs almost the whole meeting. And I never did any prescription drugs, and I was just like, oh. And I just left there kind of forlorn, just empty and, you know, God, this isn't working. And luckily, I looked in the book, and I went to another meeting. I went to a nighttime meeting, which I was scared to go to a nighttime meeting because I might see someone I knew. I don't know why I thought that, but I just was. And thank goodness, I went to a nighttime meeting, and they had this really strong format where at the beginning of the meeting, they talked about the symptoms of alcoholism, and then the middle part, they talked about the solutions we use in AA, and then they had a speaker. You know, and so I was like in the right place, and they kept saying at the meeting, people kept talking about a sponsor, and so I found this lady. She seemed very kind. She had this kind of air that it was attractive to me, and I said, "Will you tell me about the sponsor thing?" And she said, "I'd love to talk to you about it tomorrow. Can you meet me at my home group or meet me at this meeting?" It wasn't her. Maybe it was her home. Anyway, and then we can talk afterwards. And I said, "Sure," And I thought, okay, well, where do you live? And I thought, this is a little weird going to someone's house. It's not comfortable for me. I don't even know this person. And I went home and told my husband about it. He's like, well, just, you know, keep your phone on. You know, that's what, keep your phone on in case something happens. You know, because it is kind of strange the way we really put so much trust into strangers, isn't it? I have no problem with it now. But at the time, you know, I'm putting my trust into strangers. And, but it was fine. I mean, I wasn't really that scared. So I'm driving up North 95, and it's the exit's coming up, and I look in the sign, and it says Hangover, and I'm like, oh. You know, it said Hanover. It said Hanover, you know, and but I will never forget that. I will never forget that. I'm like, you know, all these little signs along the way, just, you know, it's like the arrows, that way, you know. So, you know, she agreed to be my sponsor, and she gave me some, she said, and all you have to do is what I do. And I thought, oh, sure, no problem. And, wow, she does a lot of stuff. She does a lot. And she kept telling me all the stuff she did, and I thought, well, no one has time to do all the stuff you do. You know, but I agreed just because I really wanted her to be my sponsor. I didn't really, the truth is, I didn't want to have to ask anyone else because I had already, you know, I'd already stuffed my pride just as much as I could, and I couldn't stuff it anymore. And so I just said, yes, I'll do what you say. I'll do what you do. And I started meeting with her every week, and we started going through the book, and I was the worst. I was so irresponsible. I would not show up when I was supposed to. I would say, I'll be there in 10 minutes, and it'd be 45 minutes. And And she would give me like a firm talking to, you know, but in such a kind and loving way. And we finally started going through inventory. And we got to the part in the book. She said, you know, when we get to a place in the book, we're just going to do what it says. You know, if it says we ask God, that means we're going to pray. And we'd stop and we'd pray. And she'd say, now if the book says we asked ourselves, she says, maybe write some stuff down. We asked ourselves, you know, have I ever felt this way? Or we asked ourselves, well, I don't have exact examples in my brain right now. But she says, you know, you ask yourself those questions. If it says ask yourself, has that ever happened to you? What do you think of that? Does that make sense to you? And she, one of the things that was interesting and was that she challenged my ideas about God. But she did it in a, well, at first I was a little offended, okay, because I do Bible study. I know much, probably way more than you do. I mean, this is what I'm thinking, right? Way more than you do about the Bible. Yeah. So what are you going to tell me about God? And but obviously, the way she lived her life was what she told me about God. The way she treated other people is what she told me about God. And the way people responded to her, you know, I would watch her in these relationships, these long-term, ongoing, loving relationships. I watched her interact with her husband. I watched her interact with her mother. I watched her interact with her father. She invited me into her home so I could, and she'd invite me to whatever, anything. Her life was an open book. And I thought, well, surely there must be something you're not opening up to me. But, you know, even when it was time to do inventory, she opened up her inventory and read it to me. Because I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to talk about that stuff. I was always just aghast when I heard people share at the podium some of the stuff they shared. I couldn't believe that you would tell that you're on yourself that way, you know. But and then people would laugh. And they'd laugh, you know, because it has no power anymore. You know, whatever it was that I did 10 years ago and I've made them, it has no power over me, but it has tremendous power when I share it. You know, but I didn't understand that. But all those people that I was like, you know, that was the power, right? I'm getting hit with like the truth. And let me, so finally I got to a place where my sponsor shared her truth and I started becoming able to share my truth with her. And my relationship with God started to change. And my sponsor was not my God. So don't get that mixed up. But she was accepting me the way I wanted God to accept me. Because the way I thought about God was that I had to meet certain criteria to be accepted by God. That it was like being graded by a teacher. It was like passing a test. It was like hitting the mark, you know. And I kept saying, well, I'm a sinner and I missed the mark. You know, they say the word sin is miss the mark. But what my sponsor started doing for me was showing me that that I can be loved even in ugliness. That as I gave her, I would test her. I'd give her a little bit more and a little bit more, and I'd give her a little bit more information and a little bit more, and just see what she does, you know? What's going to happen? What, is she going to cringe? Is she going to, you know, say, like, I need to go, whatever, take a breath outside? I don't know. But she didn't. She just sat and she would just, you know, she'd nod her head and she wasn't judgmental and just so loving. And when I finally read all inventory to her, she kept saying, is there any more? Because she knew. And it really took me 4 visits to really read it because I would not give it all up. I wouldn't give it all to her. I just wouldn't. So finally, I gave it all. And when I left her house, I was going down this country road, and I felt like I was flying. I don't know. And I thought, and really, this is what, and literally I thought, I can't believe that was free. I can't believe that was free. You know, we do this for fun and for free. I can't believe she sat there with me for hour after hour after hour. And I didn't give her anything. actually, I ran over her lawn statue. So I even took from her, you know, so because I was just, yeah. And, you know, I got stuck, though. You know, we do that. I do that. I get stuck. That was a spiritual experience. It was wonderful, and I stopped. Because my biggest obstacle of my spiritual experience is my last one. Because I'll just hold on to the last one I had and not move forward to the next one that's going to be. Because I'm scared. And I'll just kind of ride this one out as long as I can until it fizzles out. And then I wonder what's wrong. You know, so maybe I need a new sponsor. That's my best thinking. You know, I need a new sponsor. And I did. I got a new sponsor. And I got one who was strict and rigid and tough. And she was from Las Vegas. And, you know, you do it this way. And you got to be 15 minutes early. And, man, she had me like this. So, you know, I went from this, like, kind of, you know, the loving shepherd sponsor, which I needed at the time just to bring me into the fold. I needed that. But then I was really dragging my feet, and I got this sponsor who was like, okay, so one time I showed up, and it was 5 minutes before the meeting, so I was still early-ish, but the agreement was that I'd be 15 minutes early. And she said, you know, Angela, she said, glad you could make it. Do you know what time it is? And I said, yeah, it's 5 till 7. She's like, yeah, well, you know, I thought that you said you were going to be here at 6:45 because, you know, Jeremy's looking for someone to do a 10-minute talk tonight, and I told him that you'd be able to do that and that you were going to be here at 6:45 like you said, and you weren't here. She said, you just missed your opportunity to be of service to this group. I'm like, okay, I'm so sorry. You know, I'm like, I'm going to be on time next time, you know. But it was true. You know, when I am not where I'm supposed to be, I am missing my opportunities to be of service. And because, you know, it wasn't very often I got asked to do anything at that point in my sobriety. And just to do 10 minutes would have been an honor. And it would have been, that group gave me everything. That group gave me so much. And if I could just give that little bit back, it would have been good for me. I mean, it just would have been what I should have done. And now I've had lots of other opportunities to give back to my group. But at that moment, you know, it really hit me that think all the places I'm late to, what am I missing in all those 10 minutes that I'm missing? You know, what am I missing? And, you know, this is one of my character defects that continues to dog me is punctuality. And, it seems so small. It seems so insignificant. I tell this to the ladies, you know, in my, you know, Bible study now, and I'll talk about how, you know, I'm just so ashamed of it, and I'm so, you know, they don't get it. They're, because, you know, I really, because I'm a recovered alcoholic, I mean, I've got to floss every day, you know. I've got to fine-tune every day. I've got to make sure that there's not anything that I'm doing that's affecting my self-esteem. Because when I start to do things that don't match up with my principles, then it's a slippery slope. You know, we were talking in the car about, you know, picking up a quarter. And then the quarter becomes a dollar, and the dollar becomes $5. And, oh, no one's going to miss that $10. And, you know, it's a slippery slope. And maybe it doesn't bother anyone else that, you know, I'm 5 minutes late. But because I've had all this AA in me, you know, over the years of being 15 minutes early, and, you know, I know it's not right for me. It's for me, you know. So, I kept doing step work and, you know, finally started into amends. I did not get into amends until about my it was before my second anniversary, but it was pretty far along. And I started actually doing more damage in sobriety than I had done drunk. One of the biggest things was my brother. And my children were like 7 and 9 by then. And my brother got a pit bull. And that pit bull bit both my kids. And it was not an attack. He was playing, but these were children, and they were both injured, you know, and I was so angry at him, and I said ugly things, and really, really hurt that relationship. Now, oh, and the other thing, I had just quit smoking. I had just quit smoking, and so I was, who here has ever quit smoking? Oh, my gosh, so you know what I was. I was not myself, and I was thrown into a life panic thing, a very difficult, you know, situation, and I did not have the tools. And I already was kind of mad about the pit bull being even around my kids already, and then when it bit, oh, my gosh. So needless to say, my brother and his wife wouldn't speak to me, you know, for, like, a long time. But I learned, I got some help with that. I learned how to make amends in this program. And I was able to go to them and make amends and tell them how wrong I was for all the things I did in response to that. It doesn't mean that what happened with the dog wasn't wrong, that it wasn't wrong what they, you know, they're, but I don't care. I need to be responsible for my reaction. I need to be responsible for my response and how I spoke to him about an animal that was just being the animal that the animal is. It was playing. It was playing very rough. It was playing. It was not malicious. And he certainly didn't cause that to happen. I talked a little bit about defects of character. And I told you about the one that really, really haunts me. Another one that I have that is that actually has improved. A lot of them have improved. Let me just tell you, a lot of them have improved. You know, but there's certain ones that seem to have more of a grip into me than others. And I think some people might identify with this, is that I can be very sarcastic, and I can be, and I think it's funny, and I laugh, and I can be facetious. And I can think that's funny, and I can laugh. And my son doesn't get that. He doesn't understand that when I'm being facetious, I'm actually like saying the opposite of what I mean, and he doesn't understand that. And so to him, I'm lying. To him, I'm unpredictable. He can't understand. You know, and he's now he's 18, and he doesn't have the same quirky. And it's not even quirky. It's not even cute anymore. I've decided it's not. It's not even funny. It's cruel. I do it to the people I love the most. I do it to my son. I do it to my mother. I do it to my mother. And it's like I think it's a joke, and it's not. It hurts their feelings. I probably do it to women I work with. And this. And you know, I've become sensitive. My heart has become more sensitive through these steps. And so now I'm becoming to have more empathy and to have more compassion and to maybe hear my words in through their ears. How does that sound? What and then to say, oh gosh, what is their history with this subject? Did I even consider the history? Maybe there's something in their past that was very harmful, and I've just made a joke about something that's related to it, and you know, so I think I'm becoming more sensitive in that area, but I don't know. You know, we grow and we try the best we can, and you know, I'm trying to live by these spiritual principles that we get here, and I love to you know, enlarge my spiritual life. You know, we're directed to enlarge our spiritual life. That if we don't, that we will die. We'll drink again. We'll backslide. And I backslide. I might not backslide with alcohol, but I might backslide with some tardiness. You know, I might backslide with some cruel jokes. I might backslide with some Netflix binging. Anyone do that? You know, I might backslide with some with the MasterCard. You know, for me, these are all areas of my life that I have that I've got to get sober in now. You know, because my sobriety it encompasses my whole life. You know, that's what that 12-step is. It's in all areas of my life, and so I'm you know learning things like making a budget and You know, and I'm learning that I actually give my sponsor this information. I used to think, no, I only talk to her about alcoholism, you know. And I've heard sponsors say, oh, I only talk to my sponsors about alcoholism. I'm like, well, you know, the 12 steps says in all areas of my life. So I really need help in all areas of my life. And I need to learn how to practice spiritual principles in all areas of my life. And my sponsor, I need to have a sponsor who can, I can share with all areas of my life, you know. So I switched sponsors again. Well, my Las Vegas sponsor moved back to Las Vegas, and I switched sponsors again, and really started sharing all areas of my life, all of them. I mean, and it was really uncomfortable at first because I didn't want to tell her how much debt I had. I didn't want to tell her what my sex life was like with my husband. I didn't want to tell her, you know, how I did at work or the customer that canceled all his policies because of something I said. I didn't want to tell her all that, but I did. You know, I finally was able to just get it all out there, you know. And guess what? All those areas have improved, you know, because once I get it out into the light, God just starts changing it and changing me. And I practice prayer and meditation. And it's so important to me that, I mean, I can't live without it. I can't even go out my door. And it didn't begin that way. I mean, I did it as a rote routine at first. Just because someone said to do it, I did it. But it's become just a part of me. And, you know, if I wake up late and I only have a certain amount of time, I just won't shower, okay? Because I will do my prayer and meditation. If I have to choose between the two, the shower gets, I can wait till tomorrow. But I cannot start this day without the prayer and meditation. But I certainly can do a little cat bath and get going. You know what I mean? So, I mean, it's just so important. And I don't even have to even talk. It's natural. What's not natural, though, is when I get into a situation like with my dad and I'm in so much fear and it's something really new and really big. And like the dog thing, too, that was really new and really big. Well, this time with my dad, I had a few more tools in my AA toolbox. And I didn't lose it. And my brother and I have been, you know, sharing some of the responsibility. And we've been working together and meeting each other up there at the hospital and doing this thing together and planning on, you know, what we're going to do when he gets out. And, you know, if you just looked at us, at our relationship with me and my brother, you'd see that something's different, you know. And sometimes I... Let's see. Sometimes I think there's days when I'm just like, I am just crap. I am just nothing. I have screwed up so bad today. I am just, oh, why did I even try? You know, I mean, I don't know why, but those days will come every once in a while. And then I just want to stay in bed. You know, I don't even want to show my face. Nobody really cares if I show up. Nobody really cares if I come to that meeting. All I got to do is somebody else can take out the trash. I mean, I don't know where that comes from. It's this old stuff that kind of bubbles up, you know, and then I just show up anyway. I go to that meeting anyway, you know, because that's what I've been taught. That it doesn't matter how I feel. It doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter even what I believe. I need to take the action. I need to keep my commitments. That's kind of a rule, you know. And if I just follow it, that little temporary, I don't even know what you call that, the meanies, that temporary state of just, you know, disgust in myself. I'm disgusted by myself. It goes away. Because someone will walk up and say, oh my gosh, I loved what you said the other day. It reminded me of me. Or they'll say, you know, oh, I'm so glad you're here. I wanted to talk to you about something. or you know, whatever, you know. And I don't get that kind of interaction when I'm at home doing prayer and meditation and reading my books. You know, sometimes I just want to sit at home all day and read my books and pray and meditate and, you know. But the rubber hits the road when I'm interacting with other people. I don't think that I can really truly live a spiritual life without interacting with other people. You know, and I can't, especially like in my home group. I tell you, I have I've been in just two home groups over the last 9 years, and I have learned so much with how to get along with others and how to really put the principles before my personality. I used to think it was put the principles before their personality. They're a little off. Just remember love, 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 you know. And it's the principles come before my personality, you know, the principles of love and tolerance, the principles of acceptance, the principles of allowing people to have autonomy, to be convicted of their own beliefs, and to love them and to look for where they're right, to look for where people are right. You know, I think the more I look for where people are right, the more I see God in them. And I've come to a place, I look for God. I look for God everywhere I go. I look for God in every situation. I look for God in every person. I look in everybody's eyes. I look for God. And I find him. That's all I got. Thanks.